Hey there, welcome to Sauce and Bomb Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Dana, Head of Growth at Sauce Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful sauce businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business a success. So today with me, again, Jason Fried, co-founder of 37 Signals, and therefore Hey.com, Basecamp, Wants.com, and most recently, Fizzy. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Sure. And we'll get to Fizzy. I mean, obviously, I want to know what it is. I saw the videos, but you'll probably be able to tell me more. I want to ask first about the calendar. I think the calendar was like the first thing we discussed ever on this podcast with you. And that was like 2-something years ago. And I'm just wondering, you know, because we've talked about, you know, shape up and 6-week cycles and, you know, how a lot of people think, okay, we'll just stick to 6 weeks and maybe we'll whip up something amazing. So, you know, simple calculation, 2-and-something years is around 18 to 20 of 6-week cycles. So what were you doing?
to build the Hey calendar. I mean, a calendar like that is a lot of work because it's novel. So it's not just recreating what already exists, which if you're going to just recreate a traditional calendar grid, there's a lot you can just mindlessly do because you're not sort of inventing anything or trying anything new. So a lot of the time spent on something like the Hey calendar, which is very novel in a variety of different ways, was spent experimenting to try to find the right ideas. So it wasn't like we had the ideas and then we put 2 years of work into it. We spent a lot of time, I don't know, maybe close to half of it, I don't know, just trying to find our way to something. And then to build a robust calendar in this way that's integrated with email. It just takes time to do it well. Calendars are very finicky. There's a lot of interactions you have to consider. There's a lot of expectations people have. Even basic things like repeating events can be like incredibly challenging to pull off accurately. There's just a lot. There's a lot to it, but a lot of it was spent experimenting. So it's more of it's more like a new product. That particular feature was really like building a brand new product from scratch. And a brand new product from scratch usually takes us a year or two because we're exploring new ideas. And by the way, in that exploration phase, in like the first half of that, we're not really working in cycles. We're sort of exploring, just me and a couple people maybe, or maybe me and one other person are just exploring ideas sort of fluidly. And then once we start to have something there, then we start to move into the cycle thing where we get more formal and we have to like ship things. But initially, it's just experimentation.
Okay.
Free flowing.
All right. I see. Sorry. I just decided to choose violence right away.
It's good.
All right. But, you know, also just about this and kind of like experimentation and thinking about it, was it also work with customers or potential users, or was it just you? Because I just recently had a conversation with, you know, yet another team that wants to challenge you maybe, or, you know, build something else. And they were like, okay, we'll just get to building it. And they're like, okay, guys, have you like talked to anybody? Have you tried to see if that idea sells, or like what's going on? Is this another kind of like, I'll build it and they will come situation? So what was yours?
We are in the, we're going to build this for ourselves camp. So it's different maybe than, the team you're talking to, if they're trying to think about building for someone else. If you're really building for somebody else, you should probably get to know them pretty well, but you probably know yourself pretty well. So our focus is to always build the first version of something, whether it was Basecamp initially or Hey initially, or the Hey calendar, or this thing called Fizzy we're working on now, or the Once products, for us. And so we don't talk to people on the outside about V1. V1 is ours. It's for us. Then once it hits the market, we get all sorts of thoughts, feedback, complaints, praise, all the things. And from there, we start to make, you know, adjustments and also learn a bit more about what we really want to do. And also we give people some time to get used to something. So when something's brand new, like the Hey Calendar is brand new, has a lot of unusual things about it. Naturally, since we're pushing back against, you know, some norms in calendar design, people are going to like, some people are going to freak out and want it the way they expected it to be. And so that's a totally fair response, but I'm not going to just change the whole product the next day because a bunch of people complained about something. So we kind of want to let people settle in for a little bit. And so, you know, we kind of over the next, you know, few weeks, months, maybe even just sort of absorb, but don't do anything with it unless there's something like literally busted and broken. That's a different story. But that feedback gets worked in later as we go. So it's up to us to mold the first version, and then we can sort of, you know, play with it after that. That's our approach, at least. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. And that was exactly kind of their argument. They were like, but you know, the Basecamp guys are doing it, and
everyone's got to do it what works for them. So they shouldn't do it because we're doing it. You know, they should do it because that's what they think they should do to build a product. If they have an idea, sorry, there's loud birds outside. Let me close the window. If they think they have an idea that they want to build, they should do it because they want to do it, and they should do it their way. You know, I don't think it's a good idea to follow anyone else's way. You can like listen and have a point of view and absorb some of it, but you got to figure out what works for you ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And to be honest, like to my point as well, there are so many stories here on the podcast as well where, you know, they built and people came that, you know, it's kind of difficult to argue that, you know, oh no, that's not a working playbook or whatever.
Right. I would say though that part, it's separate. So you can build something great and no one can show up because nobody knows about it. It doesn't, talking to people or doing it your own way doesn't have a lot to do with, are people going to actually show up and use this thing? Like, first of all, it probably has to be good, but let's say it is. The hardest part is still distribution, getting people to pay attention, getting people to know, getting people to hear about it, getting people to maybe switch or even consider switching from what they're already using. Someone's already using something. Like, it's not like when we launch a calendar, people weren't using a calendar before. Like, you have to make something that's compelling enough for someone to give it a try. That's the hardest. Well, I shouldn't say the hardest part. It's a very hard part of this. So it's not so much the method in which you build it that matters as much as it is like, now do you have something people want to try, people want to use? And if so, how do they even find out about it in the first place? That is really hard for small teams with no built-in audience, no marketing dollars, no anything. That's hard. It's like, You go on Spotify and you just can randomly hear amazing music that like you never would have heard unless you just hit like play on spot. Like you never would have discovered this artist. There's so much talent out there, and software is kind of like turning into music in that way where there's so much talent out there. There's so many people can build so many things. How does anyone rise to the top? I mean, part of it is just luck. Part of it is effort in terms of marketing. Part of it is having the right people talk about it in the right way. How do you get that to happen? None of that has to do with, did I talk to customers or not when I built the thing?
Absolutely. And yeah. This is one of my favorite questions to ask, to be honest. When people say, oh, we talked to a bunch of, you know, potential customers,
yeah.
Like who actually converted? How many of those converted? And usually the most common answer is zero.
Well, yes. But that's life. Like, you know, a zillion people are going to try something and very few people are going to buy something. That's just like the percentages in general. I think the thing is that a lot of people will end up asking friends what they think. And, you know, friends aren't also going to give you feedback that really matters. Usually they're going to be quite kind and supportive. You also, I think, can't really ask questions like, would you pay for this? Or how much would you pay for this? Or if it was $50 a month, would you pay for this? It doesn't cost them anything to say yes. So that's not a real answer either. You know, so I don't personally, that's one of the reasons we don't ask a lot of questions like this, is because I don't put a lot of stock in abstractions. I think if you want to see if anyone's going to buy the thing, make the thing and put it out there so they can buy it. And these are people you don't know. And these are people who don't know you, but they discover something somehow and they you know, take their credit card out and pay for it. That's the only conversion that really matters, not the, you know, fictitious or the predicted ones or the ones you think are going to happen or the promises that people might make ahead of time. Yeah, when you put this out, totally, I'll totally use that. Like, No, you probably won't. And it's not because it's not good or whatever. It's just like, why do you need it? You probably have something already that works and you're just being kind. So I think it's important not to convince yourself that because the people you ask, they seem to like it, that means anything. I would say it means pretty much close to nothing. You have to put something out there for real to find out if people are actually going to really buy it or use
it. Okay.
Yeah.
And yet your video about Fizzy going on, what it is about, is out there on social media to still get the feedback.
I'm doing this because I kind of want to show what it's like to be in the middle of something that we're working on. And it's not necessarily to get feedback. It's actually just to show what it looks like. Like the next video I'm going to do, I'm going to try to do one of these once every week or two. It's probably, I don't know if it's going to be the next one or the one after that, but like things I don't like about the product right now. Like things I'm like, I don't know about this. Like here it is. But I'm not sure I even like this yet. And we're just like in the mid, we're trying this. We're seeing how it feels. Like there's some stuff that bugs me. And I just want to share that because it's not something you typically would hear. And I'd like to actually see more of that. I'd like to see more people talking about things that they're in the middle of and not like just look at how cool this is, but like, look at how, I don't know this is yet. I want to do that. So I want to share that. It's not to get feedback on the product. In fact, somebody asked me, one designer asked me, he's like, do you want some design feedback on this? And my response was no, I don't. And I don't because I'm not looking for that right now. And I have my own design feedback on it to deal with. And like, I have my own thoughts on it to deal with. Like, I'm not putting it out there. It's not that you might not have good ideas. It's just like, that's not what this is about yet for me. So it's an experiment. We've never done this before where we've really shared a product in development. Like we're months away from launching it. Like this is not like a imminent, like it's coming in 4 weeks kind of thing. Like let's pump it up. This is really literally like we're in the middle of this thing, past the middle, but we're still figuring things out. And I just want to show what that process is like.
All right. Yeah. So what's Fizzy and how did you come up with the idea? Why did you decide that this is the thing you want to build right now?
So Fizzy is like, it's kind of like a bug slash issue slash idea kind of tracker organizer thing. Now, this started a few years ago, actually. We didn't begin the work a few years ago, but the idea came up. We were at a meetup, company meetup. And it was like a design team meeting. So we're just hanging around the table. And somehow we're talking about road trips, I think it was. And then somehow we start talking about bugs hitting the windshield on your car. And it was just a passing comment that someone made. And I'm like, wait a second, hang on a second, let's go back to that. And so we started thinking about this idea of bugs hitting your windshield, like these splats on your windshield. And I'm like, wouldn't it be kind of interesting to make like a bug tracker? We've been talking about making one for a while sort of, but like, wouldn't it be interesting to make a bug tracker that was just like splats on the window? And so the design, and I'll share these designs soon. The original design for this was like splats, like big splats all over the screen, as if they were like bugs hitting the windshield. And then the idea was that what you really do is you clean things up. You don't like, bugs already exist. And then you clean things up. And the idea of having a clean windshield means you're like dealing with the mess of bugs. This is sort of the conceptual idea that we began with. So we started working on that as an experiment. And then we like got so far into it that we're like, the splat idea is very cool, but like there's actually not enough room on these splats to like write text. You'll see when I share this at some point. I mean, can I share screen share? I'd be happy to show you.
Absolutely, you can do that.
All right, hang on, let me
just walk us through it because this is going to be audio only as well.
Okay, cool. Well then, all right. Well then,
so far, you know, when I think about it, because I also took a road trip on a bike, and the bug splats were on my helmet as well.
Yes.
And the thing I'm thinking about is like taking them off was just such a mess because then, you know, you have to scrape the guts. It just becomes messier and messier the more you were trying to clean it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I can't share this now. I'm seeing now I have to give Chrome permission to do screen sharing, which means I have to leave Chrome and then I'd leave. Okay. I'll do this very soon though, like online. Okay. So like, but anyway, point was it started out with a totally different idea. Okay. It was like a, maybe I don't have to do that. Hang on. Allow. I have to quit and reopen. Yeah, I can't do it. Sorry.
We're only okay. In tech, right? So
yeah, I know. I know.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm just, you can still see me. Everything's okay.
Yeah. I can see.
All right, good. Okay. So anyway, it started out with that other idea. We started exploring just for fun. Like, I don't know, this is kind of a wild idea. And then we got into this thing like splats don't really work so well. What about like bubbles? What about things like bubbling up? Like issues bubble up. This is another thing that we talk. And then we started making these bubbles, these rounder things. And that was kind of interesting for a while until we again hit the limits of like practical space with a circle. Like you can't write a lot of text in a circle and they're just, it got a little kitschy and like, yeah, I don't know. But this idea of things bubbling up kind of like, okay. And then we moved over to this cards thing. And that's where we had this sort of, I'm going to call it a breakthrough. It's not like a scientific breakthrough, but for us a breakthrough of this idea of two columns. Basically things we're considering and things we're doing. Cause we have card tables in Basecamp, which is like a Kanban style thing. And of course there's Trello and all these Kanban style things with all these different columns and things move through columns. I've always found that to be, it can be very handy in some cases, but also quite unnecessary in a lot of ways. It's just like, what are we thinking about? What are we doing? And then the doing column can shift into different things. So this is sort of this idea we had. We started exploring that. That's when we moved to cards. So this is, I'm actually talking mostly about the UI at this point, but it began, and you said like, how did it all start? It started with this weird idea of a road trip and car and bugs hitting the windshield. And it sort of carried throughout. And the thing that I noticed was that this is one of the things I'm still working through is people say like, why not just do this in Basecamp? Because this is historically what we've done. We've tracked bugs in Basecamp. We'd set up a card table and different projects in Basecamp. We put bugs there and issues there. And it's all in Basecamp, which is where everything else is. But there's something about this type of work that I'm finding currently, it's nicer to have somewhere else because you can create dedicated workflows and screens and an experience that helps you see quality without having to get all this other stuff out of the way, which is all the other stuff inside Basecamp. And so it's just nice to have this like desk, like this, almost like this accessory where quality and ideas and issues are tracked. It's more immediate just to see that is what we're finding. I don't know. I'm sure a lot of, I think one of the biggest like issues we're going to have with this thing when we launch it is people are like, but I already have Basecamp. Why do I need this? And I'm not in the business of convincing anybody of anything. I've never wanted to convince anybody of anything, to buy something, to try something. Like, here, we're going to put it out there. You give it a shot. Here's another thing. Here's another take. Here's another idea. Here's another approach to this problem. You should use what works well for you. But I think there might be something over here you might want to check out. And you might find that you like this experience better for this kind of work for whatever reason. And if you do, this is products for you. And then, of course, the biggest collection of people in the world are people who do not use Basecamp. I mean, Basecamp is a very popular product, but it's like, you know, has 100,000 customers. There's millions and millions and millions. So like maybe there's some people out there who don't use Basecamp, but use something else or track bugs some other way or don't track things and they're interested in this. The other thing I would say is we're actually building this in a way where the bigger thesis here is that so the tagline essentially is everyone's got issues. Okay. The idea that like software development has been basically the place where people have been tracking bugs for years. All sorts of other things have issues. So if you are managing a home, if you're a friend of mine manages like four or five different houses for people who rent their houses out, tenants come in or, you know, people who rent the house, the oven doesn't work. The stove isn't hot enough. The hot water goes out in 5 minutes. Like houses have bugs. I mean, hopefully not literally, but like these things have issues. What I've noticed is that like all sorts of things and systems and places have issues, but most of the things that people use to track these things are highly technical, overly sophisticated, and built for development teams. You would never use Jira if you're just managing a house to keep track of stuff that's busted, but you really want to keep track of it. And where is it? Who's on it? Who's assigned to it? Has it been done yet? How long has it been sitting there undone? These are things that you want to actually keep track of as well, just like software developers want to keep track of these issues. And so we're making something that is, I hope, and I believe is far more approachable and far more applicable to far more situations than what most people consider a bug tracking tool to be, which is primarily for technical teams. That's a long-winded answer, but that's sort of what we're aiming for here.
Okay, and as far as I remember the video, you said there that you don't really believe in like priorities, so there should be tasks that should be done or should not be there at all. But like when you were talking about especially like managing houses and stuff, right? And for me, to be honest, it makes complete sense. Like I'm not really big in priorities. There is shit that has to be done, and I'm doing it, and I kind of just develop my own little like schedule for everything. But I was talking to a developer, and he was like, I have to know what the priority is, and I have to make sure that it's over there, sitting on top so I can get to it first. And maybe the same with the house, just the way you made this example. I kind of want to make sure that the gas leak is
For
fixed
sure.
first
Yes.
before the
Yes.
bugs. So,
Yes. So we have that handled. Okay. So we have this feature in Fizzy, which I've not shared yet, but I'll explain it to you, and maybe I'll share it in the next one of these upcoming videos. Basically, this idea that you can turn any ticket into a golden ticket. A golden ticket actually literally lights up as has a golden glow to it, and it automatically shoots to the top of the list on the right-hand side in the doing column. Okay. So the idea is that while we don't have priorities in terms of high, medium, low, or one, two, three, four, five, you can make any number of tickets golden tickets, essentially, which automatically just float to the top. And no matter what sort order you're looking at, they're always at the top. And that becomes the high priority item. It bubbles up, it floats to the top and stays there. And so that to me is all you need. To your point, like there's a gas leak. What's important? Gas leak, golden, like boom, right to the top. Like it's visually obvious, it's at the top, it cannot be removed from the top, and you know it. And so that's how we're handling this. And this is actually a translation of how we handled it in Basecamp for forever, basically. In Basecamp, we don't have hard-coded priorities either. If, for example, in a to-do list, if you think something's important, you drag it to the top of the list because there's something about the physical order of something which is just absolutely true. There can only be one item at the top. Then you have an item right behind that one. Then you have an item behind that one. If you assign priorities to things, you know that like everything is high priority all of a sudden. Like that's what ends up happening is everything becomes high priority and that's a problem. But if you can only have one thing at the top of a list, like that's it. So you have to really think about what's the next most important thing, and that thing is at the top. So that's how we're sort of dealing with that situation.
Okay. All right. That makes
It's also a
sense.
little bit more fun, frankly. It's a little wacky, a little quirky, but it's actually really kind of fun. Like a few days ago, there was an issue in Fizzy that like had been bugging me. It's been on the list. It's been bugging me. I'm just like, it's golden ticket, like boom, right to the top. And then in the comments, I'm like, hey, we really need to solve this. It's been sitting here for a while. Like, this is really annoying. And it just got solved because it got elevated, highlighted, talked about, dealt with. And, that's just, sure, I assume this could be abused. You could like turn on every possible thing. We'll probably have some limit maybe at some point where like you can only have three max at one time. I don't really know, but for now, that's how it works.
Is it in any way integrated in Slack or Campfire or anything so that, something you've been talking about in the chat there could be done in Fizzy as a task?
It's not at the moment, but we are going to build. There'll be an API. We're probably going to look at some agent stuff as well as MPC, I think is what it's called, or MCP. MCP, actually, what's the acronym? Anyway, we're going to be looking at some of those things for sure. It's too early right now for that. We're not. It doesn't. It's not necessary in the building of the product as it is right now. But there'll be webhooks and some other API stuff where we can pipe things out or pipe things in.
Okay.
And so you can be notified elsewhere if you want. There's also notifications in the app, of course, and that sort of thing.
All right. No, it's just interesting because I just hosted an event in San Francisco, and a founder walked in, and he was like, "You know what? Forget about this old saying. I'm building something new." And I'm like, "Okay, what kind of AI is it?" And he just laughed, and he was like, "How do you know it's AI?" And I'm like, "Well, we know." So,
We know. We know.
I was wondering why it's not AI, and like, is there anything that's still AI, or are you kind of still guys on the sidelines watching how it unveils? What's going on?
No, we're We have some little magic that we're gonna hopefully ship in V1 that we're working on with this product. This is sort of our testing grounds for a lot of things. So one of the reasons we build new products is to test brand new ideas. So we've got some really interesting, and David will be talking about this in time, some super interesting new back-end tech for this that hopefully eventually will make its way into Rails. But right now, this is like the place we test this out. And we're also doing some AI stuff, but also some command line stuff. It's not just natural language. There's also some commands you can run that are like keyboard based, but you actually run them like in a terminal, basically. So if you look back at the demos I've given, I haven't shown this yet. I mean, it's in there, but at the bottom, there's a black bar. It says fizzy do, and there's a little caret prompt, basically, a bracket. That is going to be a perpetual, always available command line. And on that line, you can do all sorts of things. You can like look at a car and be like, reassign this to JZ and tag it, whatever. Or you can use it for just search. Or you can say, just show me all the stuff that's assigned to whoever, or show me things that are expiring soon, whatever. And it's not like you're not asking it questions about the world. You're asking about questions about the data set, but you'll be able to interact with that with some degree of natural language and hopefully a lot of degrees. We're still figuring this stuff out. So, but this idea of this bar, this is what we're calling the do bar, fizzy do. When we work on a new version of Basecamp, which we've begun, Basecamp will get that bar. We'll inherit a bar like that as well. So it'll be like Basecamp do. And this is like a new paradigm for us, this idea of the two trays, one tray on the right, one tray on the left. So your notifications being the bottom right corner, your, in this case, pinned cards being in the lower left corner. And then in between those is this command line. So, it's not like help me write, like summarize this or help me write this thing. It's actually like interacting with the data in a way that's faster than moving the mouse. But you can still do all the things with the cursor, with the mouse, whatever. Yeah.
Okay. What was the tipping point for you when you realized, okay, we're finally doing it? Because the last episode you said, not yet.
Yeah, I mean, tipping point. I mean, we've always been curious about it. I think we just had to begin exploring it in a way that we felt like it made sense. And sometimes it just takes a new thing to open your mind to try something. And this is an ex like this the mindset we're in right now with this product is experiment. This is like a new UI paradigm for us in general. There's like a lot of new ideas. Here's a lot of new tech behind the scenes. We're just open to it. So this is like a good, why don't we try this idea? And it actually started because we designed this. I don't have my sketches in front of me, but we designed this two car this two tray interface, which in Hey actually had this first. So Hey has these two trays in the middle. Reply later, set aside. They're in the middle, right? Middle of the bottom of the screen. We've now moved these out to the edges in Fizzy, and when you do that, what ends up happening is you have this space in between, and you're like, oh, there's space in between. And then you're just like, oh, what if we put something there that was like we could work with? I don't know. Like I had the terminal open in general. I'm like, well, I have a kind of a narrow terminal window and we have like a narrow space here. And there's like, it just kind of like it emerges, like something emerges here. And now we've got like this line where I could type some things. I'm like, wouldn't it be interesting if you could just like interact with this thing in that way? And like, yeah, it's kind of cool. I don't know, maybe. And then we start, well, one of our programmers, Jorge, just like dove into it. And just start making it work. And then once you see something working, you can't unsee it. You're like, oh, this is great. This is better. Can we make this really work? Like, because it works like in some controlled environments, but can we make it really work? And then we just start making it. It doesn't really work yet. It works, but like not as well as we want it to. But we're just, experimenting with this at the moment. But then the paradigm that we start working on Basecamp 5, a new version of Basecamp, and then we're like, this idea, this structural idea with the corners and the thing, let's bring that over there. And then you think about, well, Basecamp has a lot of data you can query, and like this is going to be even better over there. And I don't know, the tipping point, frankly, was just like an inner excitement over an interface idea that then like opened the possibility to say, well, why don't we maybe try this idea now here? There's a place for it. There's a space for it. And that's how it all kind of came together. I mean, we've been using LLMs and stuff internally for I mean, all individually as well, just for fun and for programming and for design, for asking things about the world and whatever. So it's not like there's some big revelation, like we just discovered these things. It's just like we didn't really have a place for it before, didn't really fit anywhere. And so now we've baked it in from the start with a new product, and I think it feels pretty good.
All right,
I'll show this off soon too. It's again, not like fully functional, but I'll show some things that do work. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Looking forward to it. It's the way you talk about this, it feels like you're in a very much in the UI kind of experimentation phase, but I want to talk about your last experiment, which is Campfire, and how it's going, and you know, what are the learnings so far? Because, you know, it was a big boom for a while, and then it died down a little bit. And to be honest, I haven't checked anything recently, but maybe you can tell me.
Yeah, so Campfire was our first once product. Once is this idea, once.com, where you buy something once and you get all the code and you install it yourself and you run it yourself, and there's that. So started out big boom, big boom, like we're selling lots and lots and lots of copies. And then it's kind of petered out. So we sell a handful of copies a week at this point. So it's not like it's not paying any bills. It's sort of just a steady trickle at this point. And I think that the reality is, I think what we've discovered is that this is quite a difficult business model. Especially like, even though we've made this extraordinarily simple, like literally there is one command you run in a terminal, it installs everything, and you don't need to know anything about how to run anything, and it works. It's almost too good to be true. But even that is still too much for a lot of people who just don't want to deal with installing their own software. I think we're actually just really early right now on this. I think this is going to become more and more of a thing, but we're just too early. And like these super early adopters, they bought it and they're using it. And there's some wonderful examples of being used in incredibly interesting places. I was doing a podcast yesterday, and the woman who's hosting it, she's like, we just got it. We're running our whole community on it. Like, it's great. It's like Slack would be enormously expensive. Like, this is like $300, and like, we have an IT guy and he set it up and it's great. It's killing it. It's working great. I'm like, that's exactly what this is for, you know? But there is a technical hurdle to get over. So, and we've made another once product called Writebook, which lets you publish online books, and that's entirely free. You get all the code as well. But I think that we've kind of put that idea on the back burner for a minute, and it exists. You can go buy Campfire, you can go buy Writebook. We've made a variety of updates to both of these products, but they're kind of going to sit there for a little bit, and they're just not going to pay the bills. So Fizzy is going to be released as a SaaS product. What we've actually talked about, or laying the foundation for this, is the ability potentially to go from SaaS. So let's say you're using Fizzy. This doesn't exist yet, but this is something we're thinking about and working on. Using Fizzy for a year, for two, and you want to host it internally later. You decide later on you want to bring this in-house. We want to make that possible. So that's another path we might follow, which is starting everything out on SaaS and then giving someone the option to essentially buy it out and then host it locally. That would be kind of an interesting path. So we're not done chasing this and exploring this, but it's not going to take over the world. You know, I mean, that was never the intention anyway, but it's a hard road. And I would encourage, people have been asking me, like, I'm starting something new. Do you think I should do this? I think you should do SaaS still. I think if you want to have steady income, you need to have reliable, repeatable income. And selling software one-off is still very hard. It's different perhaps if you sell like desktop software where you double click and install whatever, but like server-based software is still hard for people, even though what we've done is it couldn't be any easier, basically, and still too hard for some.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
Yeah, yep. That makes so much sense, to be honest.
And it's, you know, like, again, like, this, like, we don't regret doing this at all. Like, we actually learned a ton. A lot of ideas came out of this. Some actually really fundamentally important ideas came out of this. And it was an experiment, you know, and that's cool. Like, I'm totally fine with that. And we might continue this experiment down the road. We're not, like, the products are still available and everything as well. So they're not going away or anything like that. But we're just focusing on other areas right now and other business models. So that's just sort of how that panned out.
What is the fundamental idea that came out of it?
There's some technology that came out of it. So some I'll just say, like, some database stuff came out of it that David will be talking more about later. But there's some underpinnings here which have been extended in a sense to Fizzy, and then potentially in the future to Basecamp or other tools that we might make. So there's some fundamental insights there. There's also some interface stuff. So on the interface side, Campfire and Writeboard have their own very, very simple interface. Like, those products are remarkably straightforward and simple products, like, very simple. And a lot of those ideas, some fundamental ideas on, like, inviting people, on setting screens, on some other design architecture-y things, are making their way into Fizzy and then going to make their way into Basecamp 5 as well. So it was a place for us to prove some new interface ideas, some new technology ideas, and to get back to, like, what is the simplest possible version of this thing? That's a nice place to be again and to sort of reset. And so we're trying to bring that into Fizzy at a slightly more sophisticated level. But still, like, two columns, colorful cards, a handful of buttons, and that's, like, it. There's, like, a lot you can do, but not much to do. That's sort of what we want. That's the kind of balance we're looking for. And again, it's very hard to experiment in that way unless you have a blank slate to start from scratch and allow yourself to try something brand new.
All right. Yeah, yeah. Maybe next episode should be with David, and I'll call it some database stuff.
So. Yeah. I mean, give us a few months. Okay. I think when Fizzy's out, assuming that this all makes it out in terms of this tech that we're working on, the plan is that it does as part of this, but if it doesn't, it won't. But if it does, it'd be very interesting to talk about. I'm certainly be willing to talk about it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Another thing that I really, really wanted to talk to you about, because, you posted this new role. I think it was a designer, product designer role.
Yes, yes.
And it was, you guys got something like over 1,400 applications for it. And one that stood out for you had, like, this insider joke. And obviously, right, you yeah. know, it's great. You know, I also love these things. Like, if you come unprepared, it's bullshit. I don't like it, no matter how experienced you are. Yeah, what else stands out for you? Because, you know, we're hiring left and right now, and we're trying to figure out what is that makes it a good hire in 2025.
Well, yeah. And actually, we just extended the offer yesterday to the person we chose. It was very hard. Finalists were extraordinarily good, and it was an extremely hard decision. The hardest decision we've ever had, actually. Okay. So we get a lot of applications. About half of them you can just dismiss off like immediately, because they're clearly unqualified, didn't follow the directions, blasting things to every job site they can find. Like, you can tell very quickly. So we kind of pare that down. Then from there, maybe it's a little bit more like 60%. From there, you kind of have this really, we're still talking like a big number, like, let's call it 500 potential people here. We tend to look at a couple things. So we look at cover letters. We look at, like, an effort. I look at cover letters and effort. don't look at resume, don't really care where you...
Cover letter is still a thing.
For us, it is. We require it. We require it. Primarily because we mostly write through communication or communicate through writing here at 37 Signals. So we want to find strong writers and people can explain themselves. And also to me, it's a signal for like, do I want this job or am I just applying broadly to any job? And if you write a cover letter that's like, dear hiring manager, and it's very generic, I know that you're not really interested in this job. So it's a filter. It's a filtering mechanism. It's also an indication of effort to us. So effort is very important to look for, I think. And so a lot of people who go to the extra effort to like make a little micro site or a little mini site or something, they tend to float to the top for us immediately because I'm like, this person really wants this job. They put in the extra work. They put in the extra effort. So they're automatically in like the next batch of, they make it through to the next batch. In a sense, golden ticket. So it's effort and communication style. And like, then there's just an aesthetic that, you know, taste, you can kind of look at tastes sort of in a sense. But the other thing is the other thing about the cover letter is that people typically will tell a story that's important. I think like, who are you? Why this job? Like, that kind of stuff's important. So kind of whittle that down. And then we just sort of like, you kind of go from there and you start to just intuitively get a sense for, excuse me, for who would be good for the team? Who would be right for this job? You know, Andrea and Bethany, who sort of run our people ops, they are the first line of interviews and filtering. So we'll filter it down. They'll talk to some people. They'll whittle it down a bit more, and then the design team gets involved. So typically it's two people on the design team who then get involved. We're down to like 100 people or whatever, and we kind of whittle it down to like 20. And then, you know, how do we make these decisions? I mean, you get a sense. Like, you look at the work, you get a sense, you understand what they're doing. We get down to the five people who we really think are the strongest. I know I'm like jumping over a million levels, but like, and then we give them a project. We pay them for this project. We give them a week to do the work. And this particular project was Basecamp's home screen, not the marketing site, but in the app. Currently, it's a collection of cards that take you to projects. And the project was, hey, look, right now this is like a place you go to and then you leave very quickly. It's not very useful. It's more like a jumping off point, essentially. How could you make home a place people wanted to visit more often? How could you make this screen that you log into when you log in more useful rather than just a place you want to leave as fast as you can, essentially? Not because it's bad, but because there's nothing to do here. So it's like this broad direction. And five people turned in an assignment. And two people immediately rose to the top. It's really interesting because you have these five people who are really strong. And the work just always separates the finalists, the top two usually. It's just very obvious. It's not that the other work wasn't good. It's a combination of there wasn't enough imagination. There wasn't enough creativity shown. There wasn't enough design chops shown. It was like just moving around things that we had. We're using our styles a lot. It's like, I want to see you in this. Who are you? Anyway, two rows to the top, reviewed them in detail, interviewed them in detail. That's when I jump in. I'll jump in on the final interview. And then we had a long deliberation, multiple days of, not full 8-hour days, but multiple calls over multiple days. Let's sleep on this. I don't know. Wavering between both. Like, I think it's this person. Nah, I don't know. Let's sleep on it. You know, and then eventually we made the call. And I'll tell you that, a core part of it, excuse me, was this is a weird thing to think about. Like, it's hard to quantify, but sometimes when you get down to the final two people, a certain desire comes out in one of them where you're like, this person really, really wants this job. And there's a bit more hunger. There's a bit more sense that this is going to mean a lot to them in a way that they're going to just level up because of that. I don't know how to quite put it, but there's just a hunger there that ends up because when two people are so good, either one of them is an excellent designer. So then you start to look at some of the intangibles, and those are the things that ultimately kind of nudge you one way or the other. So I know that's a long story. I don't know if it was useful, but that's kind of how we ultimately.
My question, just based, you know, on every other interview we had, and you talking a lot about the gut feeling. My question is, how early have you actually known that the person you hired will be the person?
So it's a really great question. We did not end up hiring the person that we initially were almost perfectly convinced would be the right person. And I will say that the person we did not hire would also be the right person. Both of them at the end of the day would have been extraordinarily good here, but we were not going to hire two. So, it was very interesting because I remember earlier in the process, this one person stood out so far above everybody else that it was like, why don't we just hire them right now? And it turns out we did not ultimately hire that person. Which was a really hard decision, incredibly hard decision. But something told us this other person was the better hire for now. So that was that. It was very hard. I mean, in any hiring process where you're fortunate enough to have two outstanding candidates, finalists, or three or four or five, there's almost no right decision because any one of them would have been outstanding. But you have to choose. And then it's just like you end up almost in a sense, this is going to sound negative, I don't mean it, but like you just like end up flopping into one camp or the other. You're like, I don't know, let's just, you know, and you just like, you go for it. You know, you often lose great people that way because like this other person was awesome, truly. But, you know, so was this other person that we hired. So, you know, I don't know, that's how it goes. But no, this was a case where actually in some ways a sort of a dark horse who was like really good, but we weren't totally sure. And then ultimately came through in the end.
Okay.
Not a long shot. Actually, dark horse is the wrong word. Not a long shot. Like a favorite to win, but kind of came from behind in a sense still and just kept... And every step of the way kept impressing more and more and more. And the final project, I think, you know, was really the key differentiator.
I get what you mean. All right. Another question that I wanted to ask, kind of in the same, a little bit of a universe, but one of the things that we also talk a lot about now at SaaS Group, you know, we're growing and the brands are growing and everything. And I feel like I know what you're going to say, but still, measuring developers' performance, you know, productivity, efficiency, whatever, velocity. Do you believe in that? Do you think there is a good way to do that? And if yes, maybe there is a way that you guys do it in Basecamp and can share.
Yeah. The answer is going to be unsatisfying. It's like, you know, or you don't know, like you pretty much know, like, you know, who's pulling their weight, you know, who's good, you know, who's improving, you know, what trajectory people are on. So it's not so much about measuring performance. It's about paying attention to trajectory. Is this person getting better? Are they junior and they're like on an amazing track? Have they sort of stalled out? Where have they stalled? Some people stall out. Like, not that they're not good. They're just like, that's the best they're going to be. And depending on who they are and how long they've been here and what they're doing, what they're working on and what they're content with, we might be content with that too. At that point, it's about like, don't lose skill. Don't fall backwards, because that can happen too. So it sort of depends. Depends the track people are on. But it's very obvious. The thing though for us is that we primarily make the decision about whether or not someone's going to be here or not over the long term after the first year. So the first year point is everything for us. And the way we think about it is we ask a very, very simple question, which is, would we hire this person again? That's the question. It's not like there's no performance metrics. It's clearly something you know. Like, knowing everything we know now, we've worked with this person for a year. Would we hire them again? Because we could go hire someone else. So you're basically rehiring somebody after the first year. And that is like the most clarifying, one of the most clarifying questions I've found in business, period, is would I hire this person again? And if the answer is no, then they're pretty much out. If the answer is yes, then you're like committing to them and you want to help them get better. It's not like at the end of year two, you say, would I hire this person again? Although implicitly you're kind of doing that, but not really. They kind of got over that hump. Now you're looking at the trajectory that they're on because they're now on one. And then you're judging whether or not they're continuing. We've had a number of programmers over the years who've been around for 3 or 4 years, stalled out, and stalled out at a level that we just weren't content with. And they thought they were better perhaps than they were at the moment. And we weren't really happy with what level they were at. And that just didn't work out. So there's times when like 3 or 4 years in, it's time to let someone go. There's other times where someone's been around for 3 or 4 years and they've achieved, like they've kind of overachieved. They're happy with where they're at. We're happy with where they're at. And they might just stay there again, but they're like, they might stay at a senior level versus moving to lead. You know, let's say we have like, you know, junior programmer, senior lead principal. There's only a few principals, very, very, very few principals. There's a few more leads and there's a few more seniors. And some people might just cap out at senior. And we can be okay with that in some cases, but there's other cases where you're like, we expected this person to be a lead and they're not there and they're not there yet. And they've kind of, their curve is sort of flattened and they're probably never going to get there. That can be more of a problem than saying like, we expected this person to be a senior and now they're a senior and they're a great senior and they're going to stay senior and they're happy with that. We're happy with that. That's how we look at that. But there's not data or metrics. We do look at some check-ins. So in Basecamp, you know, we have this feature where you can write automatic check-ins where we kind of look back on what people have self-described the work that they're doing. And we kind of look back at that to get just a sense. And you can kind of pick up on like, is someone really doing stuff or not? And you look at the work, of course, always, but you get a sense there. But for the most part, it's a really good feel because we work very closely with everybody. We're a small company, small teams. We have like 10 programmers. You know, we have other people in ops who are technical and programmers, but not product programmers, for example. Like, we don't have that many people. It's pretty obvious who's pulling their weight and who isn't. And that's an advantage of being small. I think if we had hundreds or thousands of people, it'd be a very different scenario. But I think ultimately, at the end of the day, it's still the right question to ask after the first year. Would we hire this person again?
Okay. So it's definitely not about, you know, the number of lines that they wrote.
Not at all. No. Yeah. I think it's just measuring something that doesn't matter. Like if you're really efficient and you write fewer lines of code, is that a penalty? Like what? Like that doesn't make any sense. You know, we actually would prefer people delete code. Like it'd be, you know, anyone who's like removing code and not, you know, screwing up the product, that's an advantage actually. So we don't look at lines of code. We don't track things like velocity or any of those things at all. We just work together and it's pretty obvious if you're good or you're not. It's pretty obvious if you're getting better or you're not. It's pretty obvious if you're falling back or you're not. It's just pretty obvious, frankly. And it should be obvious. And I think that's the kind of company you want to have, is an obvious company.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, like you said, it really depends on like the size of you as well.
Yes.
It's just a little bit different if you have hundreds of developers. But yeah. Okay.
And also it depends on how many layers of like management you have. So... Mm-hmm. If you have four or five layers and the hiring person or the person who makes the call on whether or not this person sticks around is like so far removed from the person doing the work, then it's hard for that person to really be able to answer that question. You know, and we don't want to get to a place where it's not direct in that way. So that's just our approach. Everyone's going to do it a little bit differently. I do think though, however you do it, if you measure things, whatever it is with numbers and data and lines and velocity and tickets completed or whatever it is, I think it's so valuable to ask yourself the simple question, knowing what I know now, would I hire this person again? Because I think it just cuts through all of the comparative data and just says like, what do I really think? And I think you should have a thought about the people you work with.
Okay. Yeah. That's a great one. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. So as usual, you know, we have a couple more minutes.
Yep.
What's your hack this year? Anything, you know, anything new that you can share, you know, with, you know, you're exploring AI. Come on.
Our hack, my hack. I don't even know. I don't really use that word ever. I've gone back to sketching a lot on paper. So I, for a long time I was, I sketch on the iPad when I want to share something with someone like quickly in a sense, because what I'll end up doing is you know, I know this is a, audio only podcast, but I'll draw something on paper now. And I've just found it's easier just to like hold this up to the screen for somebody and be like, see, this is kind of the idea here. Right. And like, yeah. So I just find myself using paper more frequently actually, and quite enjoying it. And it gets me back to the roots of sort of why I used to use like sharp. I always use a Sharpie marker. So I draw with a big, thick, you know, Sharpie marker. And it's because I can't add a lot of detail. And I find that when I'm on the iPad, I tend to just like get more frustrated with the fact that I didn't draw a straight line, or like I could shade this in some way, or like I could change the line height or line weight. And like, why am I thinking about this stuff? Like, let me just get the idea down. So like a single pen. So I've fallen back into that. I do use the iPad sometimes if I want to share something in some slightly more detail, but pen and paper is faster. So that's something I've really focused on a lot. I have begun to use a bit more AI to help me refine some thoughts. So if I'm writing a piece and I just feel like there's something clunky about it that I can't quite figure out, I will often like paste it into ChatGPT and just say like, there's this part here that I just isn't flowing right. Like, do you have any suggestions for that? And I find that whether or not I use its suggestion, I typically don't like the writing style that it spits out, but it'll often help me simplify something. Like I'll end up going, you know, yeah, that's actually, I see the problem now. I don't like your suggestion necessarily, but I see the problem now. And that helps. Sometimes I do like the suggestion, but oftentimes it just helps me see something, which is pretty valuable. So I still always write everything myself initially, and then I will ask for some editing assistance occasionally from ChatGPT. I still like ChatGPT the most. I've tried Claude, I've tried some other things, but I like its style. Yeah, I like its style best. I don't know, for whatever reason, I like it the best. I don't know, it's hard to say. I don't use Google at all. I haven't used Google search for years. I've been using DuckDuckGo, but I don't search on the web at all anymore. It's all using LLMs. I mean, unless I need to go to like a web page or something that like I know, you know, like I'll find it better through DuckDuckGo or something. But I don't use that anymore.
And that's still ChatGPT, not Perplexity, not...
You know, I used Perplexity for a minute. I tried that. Like, I don't see how it's better, in my opinion. Mm. Like, for the stuff I do, I just find ChatGPT still to be the best overall. I used Grok for a bit, and you know, I still occasionally explore all these things. I find Perplexity to be, frankly, too citation driven. It's like, I don't really care that much, actually, most of the time, about like all the evidence. I just don't really. I want the answer, and like I find that ChatGPT has the right balance there. Like, it cites sources, you know, in like really small text, but it's not about that. I feel like Perplexity to me is like about that. And it's not, for me, it's not about that. So it doesn't really rhyme with me. It's an incredible product. I mean, like, all this stuff's incredible, but I'm a ChatGPT guy at the moment.
Okay. I still haven't figured it out. My son, he's 6. He prefers Perplexity for sure.
He does. So why do you think that is? Is it more visually interesting? So the part of it is that too. I think it's like nice to look at.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's just the fact that, you know, it's just conversational and he can just kind of talk and like ask, you know, show me that thing. And she'll be like, okay, yeah, sure. So here it is. And here's how. So to be honest, like I use it a bit of a, like a babysitter. sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's interesting. So my 10-year-old, we have a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old. My 6-year-old is not into this yet, but my 10-year-old is deeply into it. And what's really cool is when we all drive to school sometimes, I'll take the kids to school and I have ChatGPT Pro. So the advanced voice is just incredible. And so we'll just like the whole way, you know, it's hooked up to Bluetooth. So it's just like, you know, we'll just like tell me about black holes or something. And we'll just like, it's like, but wait a second. But like the event horizon, like it was just kind of like just talk and like go deep on a topic for an hour. And it's incredible to be able to talk to this brilliant brain, freeform. And that way, and I think ChatGPT, especially the advanced voice, is extraordinarily good at this. And you can break in mid-sentence and like, it's awesome. I think it is the best at that also. My son, like, I guess I just haven't really shown him Perplexity. Maybe he would dig that too. I don't know. But he loves ChatGPT and he's learned so much with it. It's really kind of remarkable. Yeah. Like he's into baking right now. He's like picked up all these like recipes and baking tips. And then he's into like making his own paint. So he's got all these tips on like how to grind stones down and like make pigment. And like, I wouldn't have known any of these things. I don't know how to help him with any of this stuff. I wouldn't have known where to send him before. And he just like curiosity, you know, his curiosity is leading. And it's so cool to have this deep well of answers and interactions that he can find his way with. So it's cool. Amazing time to be a kid, I think. Amazing.
I know. Yeah. I was kind of like, at first it was a little bit afraid because, you know, you're just leaving your kid with this thing that, you know, can lead wherever. But then, you know, it's also like, they don't know where it could go. And obviously they want to go to a familiar place. So we started, you know, he's 6, we started with Pokemons and stuff.
It's not going to go to like the dark world, you know, like, cause that's not their interest. They're like, they're curious about the thing. And so they just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper in the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, our adult minds could be like, well, what if they ask this question? It's like, they're not going to ask that question. And if they do, whatever, I mean, it's not the end of the world. So, but yeah, it's fascinating. But anyway, yeah, I don't know what got a bit off track there, but yeah, that's my sort of current use of the stuff.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Thanks for sharing. It was really fascinating.
Yeah.
As always, chatting with you. I wanted to ask about, you know, the biggest win and failure this year. I think it's too early. Maybe let's do another season.
Yeah. May is hard. May is hard. Yeah.
Still Q1. So.
Yeah. Yeah. We can catch up later in the year and on that stuff. Cause then we'll have, you know, Fizzy will be out by the end of the year and, you know, we can talk a bit about that. I'm I don't know how it's going to do. I'm very curious. Like, and I'm going to be talking more about this in the videos that I do. There's like, I have some doubts that are not, answered yet. And that's like totally normal. And I want people to know, like when you make something new, like, I mean, sometimes you're like, oh, this is, I'm so gung ho on this thing. Like other times you're like, I don't know. You know, and it's good. It's good to, I think, expose that sense of dis-ease or unease. I don't know. I'm uneasy about some decisions and some unsure about some things. And like, we'll figure it out as we go. We'll get there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, happy to explore and see what it is going to look like at the end of the year. But yeah, thanks for being here.
Always fun.
See you next time.
See you next time. Okay. Thanks so much.
And take care.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders. And if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS, but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.